Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
Hey everybody, it's Matt Pinfield and this is Sound Sobriety and Success. And today we welcome Mississippi's own incredible, powerful singer, songwriter, and co-founder of the post-grunge band Saving Abel, my friend Jared Weeks. Jared, good to see you again, buddy. It's been a while.
I've also been a former Walmart employee as well.
Yeah, well, I worked fast food. Let me tell you, I worked at Roy Rogers. You know, I did everything, I taxi dispatched.
I was a phlebotomist there for a while, too.
Oh, you were a phlebotomist? Yeah. You should have seen me as a taxi dispatcher before. Years before there was GPS.
Yeah.
I was just trying to, like anybody else, my daughter was, I was working part-time in radio. I didn't have a full-time gig yet. And I was making most of my money spinning in rock clubs,
Yeah.
But I would do any other job that I could do. And I was doing weddings and parties and, DJing everything. But I remember a taxi dispatching guy getting lost and yelling at me for it, screaming his head off. And years later, you're like pretending we were great friends. I'm like, I never quite forgot when you lost your temper. I'm a forgiving guy, so I don't really care.
Yeah, that's good. You have to be.
Life, that's really important, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, what they say about forgiveness, it's more for you than it is them,
Yeah, it is, because holding on to stuff and resentments is like the worst thing in the world. And it's just funny. I just thought about that, because whenever I think about that, right?
Yeah.
I think about listening to tapes, because radio was not great at the time. And I love radio more than anything in the world. But I just remember him, freaking out. And, I understand, it was a small business, but whatever. We think about all the jobs we did. I did everything. Worked in fast food, mowed lawns, delivered papers, cleaned chairs and fixed equipment at a rental place for yards.
I used to hold the flashlight for my dad. He taught me how to change oil. But you remember the dads that were always hold the flashlight. But man, I worked at Walmart. I was a phlebotomist. I was a transporter at a hospital. I even managed a twin cinema, two movie screens. I was a manager of a movie theater in my hometown. I love movies.
That's great. What were some of the first movies you remember seeing there when you were?
When I was a kid, one of the first movies I remember seeing at the Crossroads Twin Cinema was Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. The reason I remember that is because it was out at the same time as Terminator, Judgment Day.
Yeah.
And because Terminator was rated R and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves was only PG-13, my mom wouldn't let me go to the rated R movie. But I had to go see Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I love that movie as well, though.
Bryan Adams is real smash from that song. What I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Bryan, what a great vocalist and a great, talk about a guy who has, and I've talked to him about rock and roll and the history of it, and he has so much love for it. So he's such a good dude with a great voice and has written some great songs. So let's talk about that. We're talking about when you worked at, the Twin Cinema. You grew up in a small town called Corinth, which is in Mississippi. Talk to me about what it was like growing up in a small southern town and what it was like there.
It was a small town in Corinth.
Corinth then, right?
Well, I'm in Mississippi. I think we just hold our A's and a little longer, what I'm saying? It's cool. But, growing up there, it was a small town. We had our rivals in the county as far as basketball and football and things like that. I would always tell people, as when I moved to Nashville, a decade ago and introducing myself, but we in a small town like that, you either did drugs or Jesus, basically.
Yeah.
And I ended up doing both at different points in my life. But
yeah, exactly. No, I understand.
Yeah. The world, I didn't even know it was much bigger than our hometown, the first time I ever flew, I was 23 years old, I didn't even know the world existed outside, really, you know, other than what you saw on TV. But, I mean, I had a good childhood. It was a good hometown, you know, made a lot of friends, still have friends there. You know, mom and dad still live there, so we go back for the holidays and whatnot. But I enjoyed my childhood. It was a good, you know, fun growing up there. You know, made all my friends at the local YMCA, you know. It was cool.
Absolutely. And, you know, and your parents were both, you know, were hardworking blue-collar people. Who
They worked in a factory. Yeah, they printed National Geographic magazines. So like, as a kid, you know, they would bring them home, you know, and I'd spent my time in a geographical magazine, man. But I always thought it was cool that that's what they did. Because when you think about stuff like that, you're like, I wonder who prints National Geographic magazine, you know, or I wonder who invented Post-its, you know?
It's like, yeah, exactly. And where they're done, you know, like it was like the Columbia Record Club, which became CD Club or Tape Club.
Oh, dude, buy one, get 10.
Terre Haute, Indiana. I was always wondering where that was. I'm like, what is, I didn't even know how to pronounce it. It was like Terre Haute, you know?
I had to talk my mom into letting me do the Columbia House, buy one, get 10 free.
Yeah. Oh, of course, you know, because most people didn't, you know, realize, you know, they were going to send you the CD or album or cassette, no matter what, and they want to charge you like double list price. So eventually, you know, they made their money back.
Those little stickers with like which albums you wanted.
Yeah,
like,
I used to be obsessed with those, right? Because I was so excited.
Me too.
I'd be like, oh my God, everywhere. Anything that was rock, I wanted to find it. You know what I mean? So as a kid. You know, so as a Pentecostal kid who was raised that way, and, you know, like you mentioned that, you know, you weren't allowed to see rated R movies. Your mom was trying to protect you at a young age, understandably, but you weren't allowed to listen to things like Kiss or AC/DC that kind of looked evil. And I think a lot of people go through that.
And plus it was the, you know, the 80s. So like stuff like that caught on, you know. I remember seeing videos that they were playing for the adults at my church on why Kiss was evil. And, you know, cause it stood for Knights in Satan's Service, and AC/DC was after Christ's death comes, you know, which, you know, is a little overwhelming, I guess, or over exaggerated, but, you know, I'm a dad, I'm a father of three, and I completely get it. You know, our parents, are they just do what they can with what they have and what they're taught.
Exactly. 100%.
Saying, but they give you their all, I promise you, you know. But, you know, growing up in a Pentecostal family, I wasn't really allowed to listen to secular music, you know. I grew up with like DC Talk and Third Day and Christian bands like that.
Yeah, like Audio Adrenaline and things of that nature.
Yeah, I love that tune, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
and Switchfoot, of course, early on too, were a part of that, right?
Dude, they were awesome. I remember doing a Memphis in May show with those guys, and like
they're great dudes, aren't they?
Yeah, dude, guys. It was so awesome. Like the little 12-year-old me is just standing there, like, you know, like
yeah.
I thought that was great, man. But you know, I tell my mom, you know, when I turned 17 and I started listening to blues music, I was 17 years old when I saw Kenny Wayne Shepherd for the first time. He's my favorite guitarist ever. He is the reason I'm even talking to you, man. I remember, you know, like I said, coming from a small town, you know, Memphis. I grew up 88 miles from Memphis, and I grew up 3 hours from Nashville. So those were the big cities, that and Tupelo, Mississippi. So I didn't really know the world was bigger. So we would go, and I remember my aunt and uncle took me to the Mid-South Fair to see Kenny Wayne Shepherd. And, you know, I wasn't really allowed to see stuff like that. You know, I think my first concert when I was 12, my aunt took me to see Alabama. That was my first arena show. So coming to this show, man, he got up there and Kenny was just playing his heart off, man. And like he was amazing to watch him like do what he does. He just was having a good time and Noah was singing. But I noticed like this energy above the crowd, like just standing there 17 years old. Which is something that basically later on I've discovered, like, isn't it amazing? Like the power when all these people are in one place together for one reason, it creates this kind of energy, and just sitting back as a kid, like I wanted to be a part of that. So thank you, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, for leading me, you know,
which is amazing. You know,
love him so much, man.
Zach Myers
are friends, and I'm pretty good friends with Zach Myers, and Zach talks about him all the time. And I was like, you just don't understand how jealous I am. I actually live in Franklin, Tennessee, and so does Kenny Wayne Shepherd. I'm just waiting for the day I run into him at Kroger. It's going to happen.
You're going to see him at the Kroger. There's enough Krogers out there. I've been to a couple of them, but you will see him. I'm going to tell him later today when I talk to him about what a big fan you are.
Thank you.
Because, you know, he and I have been friends since the early 2000s. And
that is amazing. You know, I've been with him since the first album on, man.
Yeah, he's phenomenal, and he's a great guy. I love that, you know, from the Columbia House Record Club, you were allowed kind of one of the first crossover records was POD, who were also.
I was telling you earlier, I had to talk my mom into it, you know. So I was like, but Mom, POD is Christian. They sing about God. They do this. And she, like, accepted that. And then from there, I went on to Oasis, and then I explained Everclear. And then I went on to Hoobastank. I think those were some of the first CDs I got off of Columbia.
Yeah, well, hey, they're all great. Everclear, you know, and Art was on this show, and he's one of us. He's one of us sober brothers. And I think Noel Gallagher probably isn't in the program, but I know Noel is definitely laid off the days of – you know, blowing booze that we used to all partake in. You know what I mean? And Liam's calmed down too, for that matter. But I love that. But Art's one of the greatest guys. Seeing that show, one of the things I found out was really cool, it was interesting, is besides loving Stevie Ray Vaughan, and you know, you hear the story about Kenny Wayne having watched him play as a kid. You know, because his dad, Big Ken, was in radio music.
I imagine Kenny just sitting there on an amp watching Stevie Ray play. Like, it gives me chill bumps to this day, dude. Like, you're kidding me, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what I love. He talks about that story. But there's another person that you've mentioned that you love who I'm a huge fan of Fats Domino. Like, I love rock and roll, you know?
Yeah,
and
he's. Dude. Yeah. Well, that was what Kenny Wayne did for me, man. Like a modern version Stevie Ray Vaughan. Like when I got into Kenny, I sort of had to go backwards. I went to Stevie Ray Vaughan to Mo Pitney and on further back from the Chicago Blues. And that's when I found out there was a difference between Chicago Blues and Memphis Blues and Louisiana Blues. And it was just kind of cool how I discovered just learning all this new stuff, how it came from Louisiana and made its way on up to Chicago and everywhere else. It fascinated me. But you know, I guess growing up listening, not being allowed to listen to that type of music, like blues was an easy way to slowly slide in to rock and roll in my mom's eyes. You know, I'm like, but Mom, these guys are amazing, you know. And then, of course, the movie Crossroads. What a great movie. Freaking love that movie with Stevie Vai and the Karate Kid.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, as when they were younger, that's a big, like, gateway movie for them.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Like seeing that. Too, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Well, what a great one. You know, they're making a follow-up finally. I hope it's not disappointing.
I didn't know whether or not to believe it, but I read something about that.
They are making it. That's what I've been told, and I read about it, but we'll find out. But, you know, so here's the thing. You had, your parents were very loving and everything, and
yeah,
you know, like, you know, and in regards to your mental health, I mean, at the time, you know, you were doing good, but you had some rough stuff happen. Are you okay with sharing about
absolutely, man.
Being 11? Because I think it helps other people that have been through similar things. The whole reason why I'm so open about my alcoholism and addiction.
Dude, absolutely. Know? That's a lot of where we get our alcoholism and addiction and things like that. But I do find in things that I learned in therapy, you know, talking about things takes the power away from them. And, you know, for me, being in the music industry and doing what we've done, it's just not about egos and BJs for me anymore. You know, I've been on both sides, and I see it every night. People forget their value and their worthiness of being here and living their life. So my mission now is, you know, obviously for me, it's to prove that life can still come from broken things. And one of the things that happened to me as a kid, I was molested by a family member who was only 14 as well. So, you know, hindsight, looking back and going through years of therapy, you know, like, he didn't just come up with that on his own. You know what I'm saying? Like, someone had to show him. And as I started, like, looking into my family, I've got six uncles and on my mom's side, and just some of the things that I discovered throughout the years that they had been a part of or had happened to them, it was really eye-opening. And thank God I was in therapy at the time, because it hit me really hard, you know? And I still go to therapy. Hell, I'm going next Thursday. I love therapy, man. Like, it's really helped keep me sober, honestly.
Yeah.
But that was a thing that happened. And, you know, I used to call him from the road and just drunk as hell, you know, tequila, a bottle of tequila, and cussing him out and things like that. And, you know, he's just, all he something happened to him as a kid as well.
So yes.
Trying to, you know, hurt people hurt people. That's basically the, you know, how life is. But I've talked to him, you know, he's done the floors in my kitchen. I still carry on a relationship with him because I know that we've healed from that. And that's a very important thing, you know, when it comes to childhood trauma and things like that, is the healing process. Because the first 10 years of a child's life, they're going to pick up things, learn things, how to deal with life. It's pretty much who they're going to be at their core for the rest of their life. And we all have childhood trauma. We all have those moments in the first 10 years of our life, whether like me being molested or other people who were, you know, beat or abused or, you know, other things like that. I mean, I didn't have the tools to deal with that stuff then. It confused me on what love really was. Like, is this what loved ones do? Like, is this, because it wasn't who I was and it was hurting me. But, you know, I just had to stuff it down and go on about my life, which, you know, obviously, as time went on, you know, I started self-medicating for things like that. But, you know, the first 10 years of our life, we all experience some kind of childhood trauma or something is going to change the way we look at things. And we're going to base our life off of things that trigger us and things like that. And just living in the world today, man, like there would be so much more good people if we were just taught how to deal with those emotions and deal with those thoughts, those intrusive thoughts, deal with those things we're afraid of, things we're fear, things we're guilty of, things we're ashamed of. Like in therapy, I sat down with every one of those things and I had coffee with them. And I healed with it. And a lot of people don't know, you know, but as you start healing from these things, that's when the comfort and the peace starts coming back into your life. Because I searched for so long to find that comfort, find that peace, fill that hole. And all it, you know, all it ever got me was problems that I brought home, you know, and the reality that I was living in 4 years ago, honestly. It's only been 4 years for me. February 16th will be 4 years for me without alcohol.
That's fantastic. I just want to tell you how great that is because, you know, I come up on 4 years in May. And so we're very close in time there.
We're in the same grade.
Yeah. So we're doing, which is great. Now, it's amazing because you have so many great words of wisdom there. And it all comes down with dealing with those things, addressing them, learning forgiveness.
And we all have different ways of dealing with those things, you know, you know, like my wife, she had childhood trauma, but her mom was proactive, put her in therapy at 8 years old. And I can see, like, looking back on like who she is now, like she is so independent. She is so strong. She learned tools at a young age to deal with life. And I mean, hell, she don't even need a man. She don't even need me. You know what I'm saying? Like, she just really a strong person. And she's obviously one of the reasons that I did get into the detox program and become sober, you know.
Which is so great. Now, you've been through a lot of things. Like you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 12 years young, right?
Yeah, that was a big experience, man. Like my mom was in nursing school. So she kind of was educated. She also worked at a urologist doctor's office. So she sort of knew the symptoms of diabetes, you know, peeing a lot and, you know, sugar and all that stuff. So they checked my blood sugar one day and then she took me to Shoney's. I don't know if you remember that restaurant.
Of course I do. Yeah, it's at Bob's Big Boy, Shoney's Big Boy. Absolutely. You know,
Shoney's breakfast bar, man. She's like, you can have anything you want. So here I go with pancakes and French toast and donut, you know, everything. Afterwards, they brought me back and to the doctor's office, checked my blood sugar. And I remember the doctor saying it. He's like, you need to get him to Labanor right now. And I didn't even know what Labanor was. It's a hospital in Memphis. But I remember riding up from Corinth to Memphis. There's a stretch of highway there. It's called Highway 72. And I remember like I knew that this was a life-changing moment for me. I'm like, what? I'm going to the hospital? Wait, something's wrong here, you know? Like, what is happening? So it was a big traumatic experience for me, you know? Like, being that young and having been hurt, you know, just 2 years prior to this.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was just, you know, it scared me. of course, I ended up being okay. You know, I spent a couple of weeks there at the hospital learning about diabetes and how to give shots. And they even had a Super Nintendo game that would that would allow you to like eat certain like it was crazy. Great, great hospital in Le Bonheur. But yeah, like it was a big moment. Of course, you know, I you have to live, right? So you just figure out your formula for living with that, you know?
Absolutely. And, you know, so, you know, the first time you drank was close to the same age I was around 11, you know, kind of 12, and you were on the same age, seventh grade, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so seventh or eighth grade. Yeah. I remember, me and all my friends at that time were, we were planning it all week at school, like, cause we knew a gas station in hometown that would sell, you know, if you just walked up confidently, you know? So anyways, we all had it planned out and, we ended up, we were camping outside in somebody's backyard, you know? And so we were all drinking and I just remember, I remember the first beer, but I don't remember finishing all six of them. I mean, I'm in seventh grade. Like, are you kidding me? Like, looking back now, like, that's a huge red flag on escaping reality and not having the tools to deal with the world, you know? I remember throwing up that night. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't do it, you know, every single night afterwards. It was more of a, you know, I went on with my life, seventh, eighth, ninth, tenth. And in high school, I was like, I was part of a Baptist church, you know, I led music there. I played guitar, you know, I didn't really smoke weed or drink or anything like that, but I graduated and then, you know, life hit and I didn't have the tools. I didn't have the tools, man.
No, understood. I mean, that's amazing. Like, I think I just can relate so much to that seventh grade era of drinking and then getting really sick that first time and then not drinking again for a while, but never being in fear of it. You know what I mean? Which was,
I remember throwing up like Doritos and shit like that, man. It was just a horrible experience, but like should have known then, red flag. Hello.
Yeah. It's funny looking back, the same thing. Now, you know, look, you broke your leg in high school, which was the first time you were introduced to pain pills, right?
It was one of the only fights I was ever in. I got in a fight with one of the people I played basketball with. We were on the basketball team, and it was the night before the county championship. Like, I literally won the game. It was that moment in my life. I hit the free throws. We beat the team. We were going to the championship. So we were practicing the day before, and I got into it with them in the bleachers at that, and we started rolling around, and I broke my growth plate in my right foot. So I didn't get to go to the championship. But, yeah, that was when I knew that pain pills were a thing. I didn't really like latch on to them so much then, but I wasn't, like you said, I wasn't scared of them. So after that, you know, I spent 6 months in a leg cast and, you know, eventually life ended up going on, but it was when I had my wisdom teeth taken out and the pop bottle of pills that they sent me home with, I took a couple of them and I was like, whoa, these are powerful. So given my previous experience, I tried to hold off on the pain and save as many as I could until I got through this whole healing process. Looking back now, once again, that's a huge red flag. Dude, the only thing that saved me from that was I had my bottle of pills out on the counter and a family member came over and stayed for a little while and then she left. And I went to take one of my pills later on that evening and there were like 15, 16 gone. So it had been stolen from me.
Yeah.
Which later on years in life, that's how that woman passed away. She died in her sleep from an opiate overdose.
Yeah. It's a horrible thing. Yeah. And it's amazing because that's really, it comes down to that sometimes for people.
But right after that, man, pills were my thing. You know, I would look for them, you know, like definitely.
Yeah, so by the time you started Saving Abel with Jason, like, were you already in that period dealing with the opioid addiction at that point?
No. Well, I would say about halfway through is when, you know, Jason's got his own story, and he's sober, and he's going through his journey as well. But I would say we would, about halfway through, we both started looking for him, and we would help each other out. Hey, I found some here, you know, or whatever. We would do that and get together and start writing music. And you don't really see at the beginning of this, the problems it's going to cause, but we were just two young kids having a good time playing music, man. It's what we do. And we're going to go somewhere and we're going to do this. But, you know, obviously years on down the road, I'm in a detox center you know, naked, having to cough to make sure I'm not bringing drugs in, you know, like,
it's, yeah, exactly. That's where it takes us, you know, eventually. And we don't know always in the beginning, obviously. We think, you know, like anything else, you know, we're hoping, we're, you know, hopeful that we can handle and maintain it. And it's one of those things that's always hard to do until we come to the realization that many of us, you know, have to surrender completely and say, yeah, I can't do this. You know what I mean? I'm going to find a new way.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you know, people have too much pride to even admit that. I can't do this.
Getting past the ego is, like, essential to keeping sometimes yourself alive. That's not to say you can't have some ego. I mean, everybody, right. You know, you have to have some ego to survive, and you have to have some ego to, you know, realize your self-worth.
Yes, and you have to have ego in certain, to be confident in certain situations. Like when
so you don't get, you know, stepped on all over. But it's the other things that, you know, sometimes you've got to let the ego go in situations like that and be able to say, look, you know, I'm, this is out of control. I can make this change. You know, so you wrote this song, Addicted. That ultimately got the band signed to Virgin Records with my old friend Jason Flom. You know,
yeah, Jason, man, I still love him, dude.
I love that guy. He's one of the best. You know, he's doing so much stuff with the Innocence Project and the other things he's doing in his life. He loves music. He takes all the money that he's made and he puts it back into helping other human beings.
And the people that he has signed, the artists that he has signed.
Oh, yeah, he signed so many great stuff.
Changed music. They have just, man, it's just amazing, his track record, dude.
Yeah, I got nothing but love for Jason. You know, it's always have. He's just great. So tell me about that. You were at Virgin and you were working at a hospital drawing blood, right? And that melody you wrote got stuck in your head, right?
It's so. I used to have to be at work at 4 a.m., have all the blood drawn and down by 8 a.m. when the doctors got there. So it was early in the morning, dark, and I would just hum that song, Melody, for a good 3 weeks. And it was just one of those things I couldn't get out of my head. So finally, I went by and wrote it down.
That is so great. And you wrote it on like a prescription pad kind of thing?
Yeah, I was talking yesterday, but I was like, I don't know if that's legal. I don't know if we can say that. But yeah, it was a prescription pad and I wrote the lyrics down. Now, I didn't take the pad. I just took the one piece of paper I wrote on. But yeah, I wrote it down on a prescription pad. And I still have it at the house with mom and dad. It's the same little piece of paper, man.
That's fantastic. I'm glad that you had that, you know. But the song was not actually about drugs and alcohol at that period of time. It was about...
It was about
sex, right?
Yeah. VJ, man, when you're going down on the in between the sheets. Which funny story. Like, that was so edgy for radio at the time, you know, because Buck Cherry just had Crazy Bitch out.
Yeah.
And so that was at the point where radio was sort of leaning toward the edge. And when we got there, boy, we just jumped off the edge, man. But radio was like, you can't have the lyrics going down on me in between the sheets. So they settled on Rolling Round With Me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, one's just foreplay. One's the actual act. Like, which is worse here? Like,
yeah. And, you know, I think it's funny, too, because, you know, the things that used to get away in the 70s with radio, and I don't know if it was just because, you know, the FCC didn't care or, you know, but like, you know, like that ballads like Jefferson Starship's Miracles, it goes, I got a taste of the real world when I went down on you, girl. Like, that was in the pop lyric of that song. It was like,
oh man.
And then the Lou Reed song, Walk in the Wild, said, he goes, but she never lost her head even when she was given head. I mean, those songs were like, they charted, right? I mean, sex has always been in rock and roll, you know, in Redemption and everything. Everything else
closely related, man. Always.
Yes, I mean, you know, let's face it. You know, it's anybody in the world. Like Lemmy said, when he saw somebody doing a Beatles song at his school, and all the girls surrounding him, he's like, I think I'd like to do that. You know what I mean?
So, give me some of that.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, you know, you guys at that first 5-year run, you guys were touring with like a lot of your friends there, like, you know, like Papa Roach, Nickelback, Hinder. You made a lot of great relationships on the road because you were the nicest guys.
Yeah, dude. We are just, man, I think that's what everybody loved about us. We were just a blue collar, like middle class, I guess, you know, band.
When I met you guys, you were just the nicest dudes, and I love that. Southern, you know,
man, it's how we were raised. You know, I get people being an asshole their entire life, but like for me, that's just too much energy.
Like, yeah. It does take more energy to be an asshole, and it takes more energy to like just be negative all the time. I don't get it. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'd rather get through the day with a smile on my face. Even when sometimes you just gotta laugh at this stuff that is crazy and just like kind of get to get through it.
And us as humans, man. Well, that's how we forget our value and our worthiness, you know, because we get caught in that negative circle of course I got a speeding ticket. Of course life's this way. Of course, of course, of course. If that's all you're recognizing, that's all you're going to see, you know, like perspective and gratitude can change all that, you know, like even finding the good in the worst situations. And for me, that's how I learned was my habitual behaviors that I didn't even know I had. I had no clue. You know, I was always reacting instead of responding and things like that.
Funny, I say that, I use that term all the time, what you just said. It's like, I try to impart that to people that I care about that are going through a rough time, and sometimes like immediately they'll jump off the head. I'll go, look, step back for a minute. Instead of reacting, take the time to respond.
That's called the pause method. Yeah. I learned that. And, you know, after I got a detox, I went to 4 months, not 4 months, 4 weeks of this, what an outpatient program where that's where they taught you tools. That's where they taught you the 10 things of emotion, you know, anger and aggression and things like that. And it was at a point in my life where I definitely wanted to change. So I retained a lot of that stuff, man. And I brought it with me out into the real world. And all those habitual behaviors that got me into that detox center had to be replaced. So with the new tools I had, every chance I could, I was just repeating them. I was pausing. I was rolling the tape forward. I better not drink. I've seen me do it. I know how that movie ends. You know, things that I learned just consecutively doing the work every single day, and now they have developed into my new habitual behaviors.
Yeah, and it's amazing how you can work on yourself. And there are a lot of things that you can learn, you know, not only through the program steps and principles and traditions, but you can also, there are a lot of things you can take away, like you said, with certain therapy and just knowledge and, you know, getting knowledge about human behavior and kind of really being able to look at yourself, you know, without superego and look at those things. You know, I always say, and many of us say, we're works in progress, right?
No, absolutely, man.
You know, there's no perfection. I know I'm never going to be perfect, but I'm going to just try and get better every day to be a little better, you know?
Right. You know, and it's been really, it was really hard for me the first year, you know, especially, you know, going through the outpatient program, I relapsed in it. But like I said, I was wanting a change in my life. So I was transparent about it. Yeah. I walked in and I let them know and they held me accountable. And of course their response was, you probably need to stay a couple of more weeks. And I did.
Yeah. I mean, relapse is part of recovery. I mean, look,
100%.
I was a chronic relapser for years. I just couldn't get it. And I've said this before here on the show and podcast, is sometimes it was a situation where something was coming at me, either confrontation, a breakup, a loss, a job ending, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And even if not of my own doing, mostly. But
that's how we would go and deal with that.
Yeah, and I would go and I would be, shaking to pick up a drink, you know what I mean, to take that edge off.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how much continuing to work on myself, and I'm sure, I know you're doing the same thing, Jared, is the thing that gets you through, and it's growth, and we feel good about that. And I think,
you know, from the beginning, it's like when people would say, well, you're never done growing and you're never done healing. Like in the beginning, like, guys, I get it. That looks like a really big hill, a really big mountain to climb. But once you start putting in the work and doing the work daily, it's almost a goal. You know what I'm saying? Like, relapses happen, like, dude, that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, honestly, because I had to go back in and stay longer and I learned more tools. But it's almost like I enjoy growing now. I enjoy learning now. I enjoy holding myself accountable. I would miss the work if it was gone, because I, through therapy and my childhood trauma and things like that, I've learned how to love myself again. I never really knew how to do that, and which is why I was self-medicating a lot as well. But I learned how to love myself. I learned, you know, when all those things happened to me, who I became and why I became it. And as soon as I learned all that, we were talking about earlier, I forgave it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the beauty is when you're able to forgive yourself, you know. When you started drinking heavily, you wake up every day. I was the same way for a long time.
Yeah.
Which was drinking away last night's hangover. Yeah. It was like I wasn't even wasted. It was like I was constantly drinking just to not shake and not to feel weird.
Then before you know it, 5 years have gone by, you know?
Yeah, like, right. I mean, because you know that's what, right? It was 5 years for you, and you get depressed, obviously.
Yeah.
And it affects our relationships. You know, certainly I was not my best self in the relationships I was in. You know what I mean? So
I wasn't either, man.
So your marriage at that period of time was
wasn't
struggling because we're doing our best, you know, to try and like just get by when we're going through this.
But we're also doing all we know how to do.
Yes, exactly. That's
all we know how to do.
So tell me about what was rock bottom for you. Like there was one day sitting on the floor. Like I know I used to get unbelievable emotional.
My wife went out on tour with Kiss for like 3 months. She was Paul's personal assistant. And at that point in our marriage and in our life, you know, she was needing something on her own to do. You know, it was, she was always taking care of me. So, and the money was great. Like, good God, it was great. So we're like, yes, we need it. Let's go. So during this point in my life, I just moved to Nashville. And I was divorcing Saving Abel. I was trying to start my solo career. And life just wasn't good for me. You know, all I saw were the bad things. And so I started drinking. That was the only thing that I hadn't conquered yet, but ended up conquering me. But she is, to me, the definition of unconditional love. She has been there with me, and she has challenged me, and she has held me accountable that, for me, I think it's the only reason that I'm still alive, honestly. They were waving that checkered flag as the train was going into hell, you know, or whatever. But I was always, even through my alcoholism, man, I was always searching for something. Because we're all, us as addicts, we're always searching for something to fill that void, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're always chasing that first beer, you know? You're never going to get that feeling again. You know that, guys, right?
Absolutely.
You're never going to find, the first time you drink, you're never going to find that feeling again, so you can stop trying to.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was one of those times in life where I didn't want to live that way anymore. It had been 5 years of sitting on this black couch is what I call it, the depression, and just the same habitual cycles of how much life sucks. I was playing the victim in every situation, man. I did not know how to love myself, dude. So one day, I was such an alcoholic, dude. I was hiding, drinking in the bathroom at my house. Like, are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. No, I understand. I totally get it.
But anyways, one day I'd come out the bathroom. I'd just finished a drink and, I just had this feeling, man, how am I going to get out of this? Cause we're always in despair because we know that we don't want to live this way.
Yeah.
And I was on the floor almost in tears and my wife came and she sat with me on the floor. She didn't come in yelling. She didn't come in screaming. She didn't come in waving her finger. She sat with me and we spoke for probably, you know, a good 10 minutes. And she looked me dead in my eyes and she said, Jared, don't you think it's time? And it hit me. Like, I don't, you know, sometimes those moments in life, you're just like, it comes out of nowhere. And like you, I've been straddling the line for so many years. I've tried it my way so many times, but at the end of every Jared movie, I'm always in the floor crying, basically. Or hurting someone, or throwing up in my cup holder on the way home because Chris Kirkpatrick can drink. We have good stories and bad stories.
I've been out with Chris. I know Chris is a good dude. But I love Chris.
I love him, but he got me so I threw up in my cup holder on my way home driving. Yeah. By the way, driving. Yeah. You know, it hit me then, and you know, probably about she picked me up and we got in the car and she drove me to this place in Franklin, Tennessee. It's called Centerstone. And it was a detox program there, and I stayed about 8 or 9 days. And then I went, as I told you earlier, went to that 4-week outpatient program. And, you know, I just started getting my life back, you know, day by day. The first year for me was hard because, you know, each person does, every person on their own has their own formula for life.
Yes.
it works for some. Some it doesn't work for, and we develop our own opinions. And I never had my own formula for life. In my 20s, I was famous. Anything I wanted was handed to me on a silver platter at any time and any point that I asked for. I didn't even know how to pay the bills. Someone else was already doing that for me. So I wasn't really mature. You know, obviously that's a 10 years gone by before you know it. And here I am in my 30s, an alcoholic sitting on the kitchen floor crying. It's like, dude, you've got to get your shit together, man. You know, this isn't you. You know, this is not how you want to live. So, you know, the program, it did me a lot of good, you know, but as with anybody, you can't make a change. You could talk to your blue in the face. You're not
going
to change someone.
You have to, it's a definite inside job. You get help from your friends, from the program, from the information, from the environment, from the fellowship, but it's definitely all about you. Like, nobody
you
can
have to
give
make
that
decision. Yeah. It's your responsibility, your choice.
Yeah. And it's amazing. And thank God I saw that change, and you know, it came when it did, and we're grateful. Like, I'm grateful you and I are in the same place, but life is so much better, even on the bad days. And there's but none of the bad days are quite as bad as those other bad days. Because man, when you can't trust yourself and you're not sure, that's it, right?
I had someone ask me, what was one of the things that kept you going? And I said, well, I didn't trust myself. I said, so the fact that I made a commitment and I held to it for almost 4 years now, that's when that peace starts coming back, that comfort, that stuff you can't explain on why you fall asleep at night with a smile on your face. I enjoy waking up now, facing the day. I used to couldn't get out of bed. Sometimes I'd wake up at 6 a.m., take a drink just to go back to sleep.
Oh, yeah.
No more, man.
Yeah, it's so great not to have that happening. And just like, you know, that's one of the things that's changed so greatly. And I agree with you, like so many of us alcoholics have gone through it, is that whole, you know, I can't trust myself. Or can I trust myself? Like, what am I going to do that's going to crash and burn this ship that I'm on right now, or this car?
One of those lines is, I've seen me do it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's so nice to see that in the rearview mirror. And, you know, of course, it takes constantly working on yourself, maintenance. And in my case, you know, I'm very involved in the program and everything. It's great. Your wife, Nikki, you got two daughters and a son. That's fantastic, right? You got amazing unconditional love from your family there. It's great.
Yeah, dude. Like, I've always wanted to be a dad because I had a great dad. And it was one of those things I didn't know until I was a dad. Like, once it happened, I was like, whoa, this is awesome. But yeah, I've got Coda Rain. She's my first. She'll be 14 in a few days. And me and my wife like to wait to see what we're having. You know, she says that it's one of nature's last surprises. You know, so we had Coda, and then we had our second daughter. Her name is Harper Lennon. She goes by Lenny, and she's 10 years old. And then on our third one, this one, I don't even know how it happened, because my wife had some problems and she had a partial hysterectomy done. And the doctor was like, you guys aren't going to get pregnant again. There's no way. And obviously I turned to the doctor and said, hold my beer, because we were pregnant before we know it. And I've never rooted for penis more in my life during that pregnancy.
Yeah.
And so he pops out and I'm like, yes. His name is Scout.
That's great. That's amazing.
Oh, and Scout Boy, man. I love that little man, dude. But yeah.
That's phenomenal. And you got all those gifts. It's, you know, and they get to see you be your best self, which is a beautiful thing, really, all the way around.
You know, and if anybody wonders, you know, like, yes, my daughter Coda was raised on a tour bus. And yes, she saw the absolute worst of me. And some days I worry myself because I think that that's all she's seen. But guess what? You know what she's seeing right now? She's seeing me wake up every single day, do the work, and change my life. And to me, that message is way more important. So I, because I'm self-deprecating a lot, but.
Yeah, we have to be.
I can change. Like, I'm telling you, it for you guys out there, if you're wanting to change, if you know that you're feeling something that's pulling you towards it because you know that you're not who you're supposed to be, you can do it. It is totally possible. I am the person today that I was praying to be 4 years ago. And it has made my life. I enjoy it so much more now. And I get so much more joy helping folks, man. And that's what I'm addicted to now, like pure concentrated joy.
And being of service, too, which is great that you're doing that as well.
Give me some more of that.
You know, which is fantastic. Now, you know, back in, you know, in the mid 2010s, right? You were writing some songs with Jonathan Singleton, right? Who wrote for Tim McGraw and Luke Combs.
Dude, Jonathan Singleton, I've known him for probably a decade now, but he grew up in Jackson, Tennessee, which is only 30 miles, 40 miles from Corinth, where I grew up. He moved to Nashville. I went off Saving Abel, got popular, whatever. I came back and I started writing with him. It was one of the things in Nashville that the more I did it, I was drinking while writing. Yeah. Like 11 a.m., you know, I'm drunk trying to write. But some of those guys, they're just so talented. Some of them write 2 and 3 times a day. I tried that. I ended up feeling like I wrote the same song over and over and over. As I was sinking more in depression, my passion was all out of it. So, you know, obviously the solo country stuff didn't succeed for me. But, I mean, I don't think it was supposed to.
Yeah, and you got back together in 2021. You know, it was great. You and Jason got back together. Yeah. Got Saving Abel back together. You wrote Baptize Me. You know, so it's been, everything's been good. It's going, it's on a great trajectory, right? And yours are.
I remember calling Jason. It was right after the isolation. And I was like, hey, man, I'm ready to take my life back. And his response was just like, man, I've been waiting for you to say that for a few years now, you know? So we got right back in the studio. And honestly, it was like we had never left. And God, do I love it when things go that way in life, you know? So it was almost natural, you know, how we came back. And with the bandmates and the members that we have now, it's toughened up our music a little bit as well. You know, we no longer sing about egos and blowjobs. We're more of a, I try to write about the things I know. And during this time period in my life, I know what redemption is. I know what being a brilliant human being can be. And I know the power that we have in our lives. Like, we write our own stories, be the hero. So that's why you get songs like Baptize Me and Fire. You know, it's about change and how you have the power to do it.
But and I think that's great. And there's there's an Anthony Hopkins quote that you have too. I want you to share that with everybody. Why don't you? And I see him. You know, I see him occasionally in Pacific Palisades. Because
I love,
you know,
that man, dude.
Yeah, he's such
great
a
great actor. But this quote is one of the main reasons that that I love him even more. But you know, a lot of times people have trouble with faith or believing, you know, in things, you know. And one of his quotes is, "Believe." Even if you don't believe, play the game of believing. And that, however you that resonates with you is how it resonates. But the day that I heard that, I was like, wait, like you honestly have to believe in yourself in order for these things to come in fruition. Like, even Christians, you know, Jesus didn't say, he said, your faith has made you whole. Your belief has made you whole, or whatever scripture that was in the Bible. But that's just sort of a good philosophy on life for me these days, is because you have to believe that it's possible. Yeah. You really are a powerful, brilliant, infinite energy. I mean, we are bright human beings. We are solar, and we do contain a lot of power, and we can help so many people. We can change our lives. We can make other people's lives better. Like, helping other people and chasing your passion, that's what creates balance in the world.
It
the
does.
Universe wants you to be happy.
Yeah, it does. And when you spread happiness, I mean,
believe.
It's...
So believe. Yeah, even if you
absolutely.
Don't believe, play the game of believing.
Yep, that's the thing about faith. That's great. So, Jared, I want to thank you so much for doing this today. And it flew by.
And a privilege. I remember watching you as a kid, man, on MTV. The first time I ever met you was at Oklahoma a couple of years ago. But you were such a pleasant experience, man. I got a little nervous before coming on the show today. I was like, dang, this is the guy I was watching on TV when I was a kid.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate you guys.
No, it was great to have you on, Jared. And, you know, it's amazing because what you're talking about before we say goodbye was you and I both were at this Honeymoon Rock Festival, which was a very cool and unique thing that a woman put together who had done pretty well in tech, loved rock and roll, and put together a, if I remember correctly, it was a 2-day festival.
And they had every kind of band you could, I mean, Scott Stapp was there.
Yeah, it was Scott Stapp to Everclear to Sugar Ray. You know, it was unbelievable.
Power Man, well, I remember.
Yeah, everybody. We hung with everyone. I even like got my minister license and got people. I married some people on stage.
Yeah, was that a quick online class there?
Yes, it was. It was. It was a special church that I did online. Because the woman would say, he goes, wait, will you marry some people tomorrow? I'm like, sure. What do I do? So I went on there, decided I was the Reverend of Rock.
So you literally can be a preacher anytime you want to be. You've got the license.
Absolutely, which is cool. You know what I mean? I figure I got practice talking about rock and roll all these years and music and every kind of music, really, because I just love so many things.
Man, yeah, thank you, dude. This has been awesome. And I'm glad that I was wondering how we got in touch with you, but I was like, hopefully he just remembers me talking about being sober when I was in Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But, yeah, dude, it's been amazing to be here, dude. Thank you. It's been an honor and a privilege, dude.
Yeah, Jared, thank you so much for being a part of this today. It's great, and we look forward to the next music you're doing. And thanks for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, faith, and everything else, your story, man. It's great, and it really, I think, it transcends and gets to so many other people. It means the world.
You're a witness to this as well, because you've changed your life, but life can still come from broken things.
Absolutely can. Keep pushing through.
If you're ever in Nashville, reach out, man.
Oh, come I will.
My wife will cook for you.
Oh, I would love that. My girlfriend and I have to come see you. 100%.
Yeah, bring it.
That'll be great. And, you know, I love that. You know, I don't know if you knew this, but I was actually, even though I was raised in Jersey, I was born in Athens, Georgia. So I was born in the South.
So you are.
So there you go. You know, so it's great. And, you know, so it'll be really cool. We'll definitely get together. I look forward to it, Jared. We're going to stay in touch.
Well, continued success on your journey, man. I support you, and you're doing great.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, Jared. Jared Weeks, everybody, from Saving Abel. So great to have him on. I'm Matt Pinfield. You know, we love to share our stories, and it's just really important that you know that we're out here because we want to be of service, and, you know, we love the journey that we're taking, that we're alive and can spread the word that you can change your life. It's so important. And if you like this episode, make sure that you hit like and you share it with as many people as you can and follow us here at Sound Sobriety and Success. I'm Matt Pinfield, and have yourself a great week. If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, Sobriety, and Success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Tarion Zeldo, Booking and Research. Susan Axu Magarian and Robbie Gissell, Marketing. Sound, Sobriety, and Success is a Benstown McVeigh podcast production.